Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Motivational speaker Noah Johnson has spent years working at youth centers, juvenile detention centers, group homes, military institutions, churches, and other youth adult service organizations. He has published a workbook aimed at inspiring and motivating young men to overcome adversity and thrive. It's a guide to help them overcome society's messages as to what a man should be and become the man they would like to be, to develop their own definition of manhood. The title of his book is Boys Versus Men, The Definition of a Man. Noah Johnson, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, who is your audience? Who are you writing this book for?
I think just any male in general. I think the target audience would be about 16 to 21 years of age. But in writing the book, I learned a lot about myself that I didn't know was my definitions of a man. So I think any age, I don't think there's a specific age range for the book.
Well, I would like you to give listeners an example of what one of 52...
Yes.
And I kind of think of his essays. I don't know. You call them maybe subjects.
Yeah.
And 52 is the same number of weeks in a year.
Exactly.
So if somebody wants to read one and think about it for a week, say that looks like a good arrangement. But you don't tell us anything we've got to do.
Yes. No, exactly.
Or think.
Exactly. I'm not a huge fan of self-help workbooks written in the way of that person has the answer. And so when it comes to manhood, not me or anybody has the definition of a man. So it's, I don't have the answers and I don't want to pretend like I do. This is just a good starting spot to help you find your own answers.
Let's give them an example of one of your, what I'm calling essays.
Okay.
And this is your essay on forgiveness.
Definitely. Boys see forgiveness as a way to release burden from the other person. Men see forgiveness as a way to release the burden from themselves. My father wasn't around when I was a boy. He somewhat tried to come back around every once in a while when I was in middle school, but never was really there. I had a lot of anger towards him, and before he died, I hadn't spoke to him in years. I got a phone call saying he was in the hospital, and I went to see him. He looked awful, and for the first time, I wasn't mad at him. I just felt bad for him. Doctors said he wasn't going to make it, and for the next few weeks, before he passed, I'd go to the hospital almost every day to see him. We didn't talk much, though. He was either out of it and couldn't talk, or I didn't have anything to say to him. I remember thinking, I should say something to make him feel better, patch things up before he dies, but he doesn't deserve to be forgiven. Then it hit me. I deserve to forgive him. I got stuff off my chest, told him how I felt, and I forgave him. I'd like to think it meant something to him, but I honestly don't think it did. I'm just glad I let go of all the hatred and anger I had toward him before he left so we could go with him. A boy would carry that weight their entire life so they don't have to forgive the person they're mad at or who hurt them. A man doesn't wait to be asked for forgiveness or for the forgiveness to be earned. He forgives, not to release the other person, but to free themselves.
My guest is Noah Johnson, and he is reading from his book, Boys Versus Men, The Definition of a Man. And you say that you forgive not to release the other person, but to be free yourself.
Definitely.
And I am about as opposite as possible from
perfect
who you described as your target, but both in gender, in race, in age.
Yeah.
I'm totally different from who you were thinking of when you were writing this essay, and yet I need to hear that message.
Definitely.
So there's so much of your book that I could see there were some aimed specifically, this is what a 16-year-old black male needs to hear.
Yeah.
But there was so much of it, an older white woman.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
and forgiveness is one of those, I think,
yes,
that we need to hear. And it's especially poignant when you draw that from your own experience.
Definitely. And again, it's the guide written from my perspective. But if you were to read that and say, I completely disagree with what you just said, good. That's the point of it. I don't have the answers, and I know I don't want the world to be like me, but I want the world to be like them and understand their own beliefs instead of just regurgitating what they've been force-fed.
Well, in fact, in the very first page of your book, in your introduction, you say, I'm presenting the facts of my own life, completely expecting to be disagreed with on at least some of my perspectives.
Definitely.
So then you say, I look forward to being wrong.
I like it. I do. I did a 10-week program of this with the Washington Youth Academy. It's a military institution in Washington State. And to hear, I did it with 18 young men, and to hear the different perspectives and some of the young men just boldly saying, you're wrong because of this, this, and this. Good. Express that and tell me why I'm wrong and be more secure in your beliefs, because it's not about me changing you. It's about you understanding you and me trying to help that. This is the book I wish I would have had as a young man. I would have made a whole lot less mistakes.
Well, and I think if I were the writer, if I were you, I would rather people disagree with me than just be apathetic and not say, well, that doesn't pique my curiosity. I don't
Definitely.
Care about that.
Definitely.
But when they disagree with you, that shows that they are really moved by what you wrote.
Yeah, and they're thinking about it and they're analyzing themselves. And it's not just, I'm going to agree or disagree just to do it. It's that thought.
Well, you mentioned in your essay on forgiveness, your father.
Yes.
And you say, my father wasn't around when I was a boy. And I happened to notice a shiny object on the finger on your left hand,
yes.
Noah.
Yes.
And it's so shiny, it looks brand new.
It is brand new. 2 days. I have been a husband for less than 48 hours now.
So congratulations
Thank
on
you.
Getting married.
Thank you.
And you did say that being referred to as husband is such a new experience because you didn't hear that word around your house when you were growing
yeah,
up.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I didn't have that father figure that was, this is husband, this is wife. I had my mother. And I had a stepdad for a few years, but there wasn't that constant of that. So I knew I would have a wife one day. I just didn't know that came with me being a husband. So that was weird to me.
So calling this other person my wife is, that's what you kind of anticipated.
Yes.
But having her refer to you as her husband.
Yeah. Yeah. She puts cute little spins on it, like hubby and things like, I don't know how to take any of it. I just love though. So I'll accept it.
Well, why did you give your mother a Father's Day card?
My mother was my mother, my father, my friend in a way that I feel a parent should be, not that my friendly parent, but she was always that person to me. And so that role of a father, there were times growing up I would even say to her when it was an uncomfortable topic, all right, I need to talk to my dad right now. And she would do her best to listen to me and not be uncomfortable by those conversations, as uncomfortable as it was. So she was always that role to me, and she stepped up and did the definitions of a man that I wish I would have had the best she could.
So you would actually say to your mom, I need to talk to my dad
yes.
right now, not meaning you were going to pick up the phone and
yeah,
call your
no.
actual dad, but
I need you to be that role for me right now. And she did her best. It wasn't always perfect, and it wasn't comfortable, but it was helpful.
Well, I did enjoy what you wrote about your mother because I could see the love and respect and admiration for her coming through your words.
Definitely.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
So there's a definition on the cover of your book.
Yes.
That you don't even agree with. No, you put
I don't.
Something on the cover of your book
yes.
that you don't agree with.
Yes.
What is that?
So that is my interpretation of what I feel society tells young men, especially my target audience, that a man is.
Okay, let me reiterate. The cover of your book says Boys versus Men, the definition of a man, and then under that is
yes.
a definition that you don't agree with.
Yes.
And what does that say?
That says a male over the age of 18 years old living in a constant state of self-destruction. And I believe society's definition of a man leads our young men to paths of self-destruction. It's I know me growing up when I was over the age of 18 years old, I didn't have the most respect for women, even though I had my mother. Because the men I looked up to didn't have that respect for women. I didn't have that positive male role model until I was 18, 19 years old, was my anger management counselor, was the first positive male role model that I had.
Now, let me pause for just a second. You said my anger management
yes.
counselor. So were you ordered to anger management? Because I know some businesses, they will order an employee to take anger management courses.
No, there were times in my life where I realized it was an issue, and I got in a lot of trouble. I got in a lot of fights. I lost a friend when I was 16. He got killed. He was 23, and he was somebody I was looking up to, but we weren't doing the most positive things. That's how he lost his life. And then when I was 19, I had a young friend who was like my little brother. He was 16, and he got 12 years in prison for doing the same kind of things. And so at that time, I realized things need to change. I'm going to end up dead or in jail if I'm continuing on these paths. And so it was kind of something, a little bit I knew I needed change, and then a little bit I was getting into trouble, and I thought this might help me if I go to anger management to show I am trying to help myself out.
So this was at your own initiative?
It was,
that you sought it out. Because I think it would be so easy to realize something was wrong and that you needed to change direction, but wouldn't know how to go about that. So I think that's compliment to you that you realize, okay, here's a path. I need to go get some help with my anger.
Yeah, yeah. I will take half the credit because my mom had me, she was trying to do counseling with me before because of all the issues I was getting into. So it was a mix of understanding I did need help and that I didn't want it to be that path, but maybe an anger management counselor that she recommended from work, or she knew him somehow before, and he became a big part of my life after that.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a young person, 16 years old.
Yes.
Who got 12 years in prison.
Yes, he did. He's been out now for about a year and a half.
And you say that was a life-changing, would you say?
Yeah,
a redirecting of your life?
Yeah, that was my turning point. At that point, I stopped talking to people. I became very introvert, and I also started dealing with a lot of depression and anxiety and anger, and there were a few years of my life where it was pretty much every day suicidal. Today's the day I'm going to do it. I was planning the ways to do it. I was very dark years of my life through that. And through volunteering and working with youth and giving back and finding a positive way to spin all the negativity in my life to help the youth, I felt a purpose in life again. And that helped the depression and the anxiety, and it guided me in a positive direction.
So when this young 16-year-old gets 12 years in prison, you realize you didn't seem like you found the path just then, because you say you went through depression for 3 years.
Yeah.
That must have been upsetting for your mother to see you that way, Noah.
Yeah, and not having answers and going to different doctors and doing different trying to find cures for why I'm feeling this way and finding more dead ends, which just made things worse. And I remember going to a doctor thinking I had this certain disease. I don't remember what it was, but I went down to San Francisco and I was sitting in his office and he says, "You don't have this." And I remember thinking, like, I'm just going to jump, because we were high up. That was one of the lowest points at that time. And then I started to figure out what was going on a little bit, and talking to people and finding that purpose in life really helped me out a lot too.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'll be back with my guest, motivational speaker and author Noah Johnson, whose book, Boys Versus Men, encourages his readers to question teachings that kids carry into adulthood. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest, Noah Johnson, wrote a guide, Boys Versus Men, to help young men overcome society's messages as to what a man should be and become the man they would like to be. And so when you work with these young people, these groups in juvenile homes, and you're not some person apart from their experience. When you say things, it comes from your experience. You've experienced these things. So
yes.
If they have depression, you've been there.
Yes. Yes, definitely. And to be able to let them know, the hardest thing dealing with is you think it's always going to be this way. And you think, well, why am I going to continue being here if this is how it's going to be? I want to live, but if it's going to be like this, I don't want to live like this. So to try to impart that hope, and it gives me a purpose too. It allows me to know I went through these things for years, but there was not a reason that I went through them. But now I see there was a reason, so I can now give back and help other people in the same position. So it helps me out. It's a full circle of help going around.
In fact, you say that writing this book you gained insights, just the process of writing this book. So even if it were never published, even if you just wrote it and it sat on your own shelf.
Yeah. I mean, no matter how old you are, you could ask a guy in his 50s, what is your definition of a man when it pertains to happiness or adversity or just these topics in the book that you don't ever think about? And part of being a male, we're told we're not allowed to talk about a lot of this. And then part of it is, when do you have the opportunity to sit down and consider these things and then have a sounding board or another side to bounce that up against, which is what the book provides, that other side of that perspective.
You also make the point that even though you have an age range that you aim this book for, a person can be a boy still at the age of 50.
Yes.
And yet a 15-year-old can be very mature.
Very much so.
And I've encountered this myself with people who are young teenagers that are so mature and so responsible. And I just admire them so that they are able to do that. And your book, you give the point of view, if you're still immature, if you're a boy, here's the way you see this situation or this characteristic.
Yeah.
And if you are a mature person, doesn't matter your age, but if you're a man, if you are mature, then here's how you see it.
Yeah, and I when I wrote the book, I thought I was where I should have been at. To this day, I think I'm a mature man. I will hopefully continue to grow past this age and become more mature. But when I wrote it, I thought I was good. I'm writing the book on it. I think I'm good, and I know who I am and the perspectives I have. And in writing it, I realized I didn't even know I felt this way about this. So now moving forward, I have an obligation to myself to carry myself in a certain way, because now I understand how I truly believe and how I truly feel. I can't, once you know, you have to know. It's not, I can't be ignorant to it anymore, because now I have the facts of how I truly feel.
You say that young men are taught things that they, and I think this is true of all of us. When we're kids, we're taught things that we don't question. This is just the way life is, because the adults in our life tell us this is how it is.
Exactly.
And you're encouraging to question and not accept these things unquestioned. You're on the cover of your book that the word man is a noun. It's societal. And it defines it as a male over the age of 18, living in a constant state of self-destruction.
I mean, look at what we see as a man, especially in cultures where we're not completely represented in the media. If you look at a brown or a black man in the media, you generally will see negative portrayals of that. At least that's the main thing that you see of it. So if I'm living, and this is from my own personal experience, if I'm living without a positive male role model, and I'm trying to become a man, which was my, I think most young men's number one priority is to become a man. How do I become a man? Where do I look? These people look like me, so this is how I'm going to look, and how I'm going to dress, how I'm going to carry myself. So most of those images are of self-destructive, whether it's being on drugs, selling drugs, being in a gang, being violent, having to stand up and fight for everything because this is what a man does. I can't be put in my place. I learned it. I was learned pretty late. I was always really bad with male teachers because a man never told me what to do. So now I'm in middle school.
And you resented that. You didn't want a man telling you what to do.
No, because a man doesn't let a man tell you what to do. And so in middle school, I'm trying to be a man. I used to tell my mom all the time, I'm a grown man. And she would tell me, no, you're not. And we would have conversations on that. But I was just trying to become a man. So I'm seeing men, okay, the men around me aren't getting told what to do. So a male teacher's not going to tell me what to do. So now I'm not passing any of my classes with male teachers. I'm getting into arguments with them because I can't, as a man, allow another man to tell me what to do. So that carried on in jobs. I'd have male bosses or supervisors that try to tell me what to do. And now it's hurting my pride because I'm trying to be a man, but I also have to work because I'm a man. And I also have to, so just all these self-destructive
behavior. Working against yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Very, very self-destructive.
Well, your seventh essay, I'm going to call it, is on listening. And you say, boys know when to talk. Men know when to listen.
Yes.
And that's a hard one. You say, when I was younger, I always had something to say. If I didn't like what you said or you did, I was going to let you know. Mm-hmm. I always had an opinion I needed people to hear. I wasn't hearing anything other people were saying because I was always thinking about what I was going to say next. Sometimes the strongest voice needs to be the quietest. I remember a few times hearing someone talk disrespectful to an older guy, and he just stood there listening, didn't say a word. I asked him, too, are you just going to let him talk to you like that? because, you know, I always had something to say. And he just looked at me and said, "You weren't listening to a word he said, were you?" And then you say, "It took me years to figure it out." You can't always let people know that you know the cards they're holding, because once you do, they change the way they play the game. Always having something to say isn't a strength. Strength comes from knowing when to close your mouth and really listen.
Yes, and I'm trying to carry that with me through being a husband, because I can't always just say what I'm thinking, especially when she's so much smarter than I am. I have to just listen. So I'm glad I learned that myself.
That is music to wives' ears.
Yes, there are a few.
A husband who will listen?
Yes.
Oh, my.
She's smarter than me, so I have to listen.
Well, you're off to a good start
then.
If you are willing to listen.
Thank you. I'm 48 hours in, and I'm trying to do my best. I don't have it figured out yet.
Well, teenagers in particular don't like to listen because they already know it all.
Yes, they do. And it's frustrating because once those teenagers get grown and they try to talk to a teenager, it's going to happen to them too. So it's just you have to listen more than you talk. And if we looked at our greatest minds throughout history, most of them didn't talk too much. And when you listen to older people talk, generally they don't talk a lot. But when they talk, you listen. And so I wanted to have more substance to what I say and to what I speak. And words are very powerful. And you don't always need to use them.
My guest is Noah Johnson. He's a motivational speaker who has written a workbook, Boys Versus Men, The Definition of a Man. And after each of your essays, as I'm calling your topics you explore, there's a page where you have little boxes where the person reading this has just read what you had to say, for example, on listening. And they can check the box that says agree, disagree, or both. And then you have a space for them to write in why I feel this way, and then my definition of whatever it is you just presented.
Yes. Yeah. So they can read it. A lot of times they would agree. You can write agree, but don't just agree. Why do you agree? And what parts do you agree? Or disagree? And why do you disagree with this? Again, I don't want you to agree with me all the time. I think the world.
But you do want them to know why they are disagreeing.
Exactly.
If they do.
So know why that is. So if you learned this from a man, if you learned X from a man and you just go throughout your life, do you truly believe that? Or if you do, why do you believe that? And does that also match up with your morals and your belief system? And if not, you have some self-exploration to do.
Well, Noah, there's something that I was impressed with as a lover of reading and books, and that is that you started a book club for young men.
I did.
I was so impressed.
Yes, thank you. We started I'm not sure if you're familiar with the African American Family Culture Center in Oroville, but I got my anger management.
So that was your hometown, was Oroville?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, I'm from Oroville. Mm-hmm. So the African American Family Culture Center was a vision from Clay. So my anger management counselor was Ricky Hodges. That was my anger management counselor. His cousin Clay had the vision of the African American Family Culture Center, and those two brought me on to create the African American Family Culture Center. So I was 21 years old when we started that process, us three going forth and trying to get that to start. And before we got the building or the funding or any of that, we started using the library in Oroville and bringing in young men and doing a book club by African American authors and teaching them love for reading and opening up their mind. And that was something that those conversations we had was a huge experience that helped with the book too, to understand those open-minded conversations, especially involving adults and youth together and different perspectives, was huge in their growing and their learning and their love for learning. And that really opened the door for me.
So would you lead these discussions on the book that they would read?
We would. It wasn't a really formal way of doing it, which was nice because we would just read, and then whenever.
So they didn't have to do homework. So
no,
to speak.
No, no.
They didn't have to read at home. You would read it there together.
Yes.
And
yeah, we would sit around and read, and then the next person would read, and whenever anybody had anything to say, we would just stop and have a conversation on what we just read. And sometimes it would go 10, 15 minutes without a conversation. Sometimes almost the entire hour and a half that we were there, we would just have a conversation. And that was really good to see, for the youth to know adults are listening and vice versa. Everybody listening to one another in different perspectives. We all grew from that.
My guest is Noah Johnson. He's a motivational speaker, and he has spent years working in youth centers, juvenile detention centers, group homes, military institutions.
Yes.
And I would think you would run into the same kinds of problems with anger.
Yes.
In all of these places.
Yeah, every single one, and there's different varieties of it, but the anger I feel, especially as a man, I feel like we're allowed a couple different emotions growing up. I'm allowed to be happy. I'm allowed to be angry. That's almost it. So whether I was feeling lost, I'm just angry. Whenever I'm feeling sad, I'm just angry. You just convert that to anger. So when I'm getting in fights, right, it's my pride, or I'm hurt, or I felt left out, or no matter what other emotion it was, I'm not allowed to feel these, but I'm allowed to feel anger. And I got really good with anger. Anger became one of my best friends growing up, because I'm not happy. So what else am I? Those are the two options I have, because I'm not allowed to be sad, because a man's not allowed to be sad. So all of these topics, everything, all of the issues I got into was mainly issues that had nothing to do with anger, but that's how I expressed them.
In fact, I would think some of the young men you work with would be expressing anger and not really knowing what the real emotion was that they were experiencing. They just expressed it as anger when that really not necessarily what they were experiencing.
Yeah, because they're not allowed to be sad.
But did you have a favorite of the essays that you wrote?
The forgiveness one was a favorite. Also, happiness. Happiness is the last chapter in the book. I wanted to end it on a positive note.
Yes.
So happiness is one of my favorites. Do you mind if I read that one?
Please do.
So this is chapter 52, happiness. Boys look outward to find it in material things. Men look inside themselves. I grew up in a family without much money. I had to do without a lot of material things I wanted. I spent some of my teen years making quick money, and a lot of it. My early adult years, I was broke, working multiple jobs, and I've had good-paying jobs where money wasn't an issue. The number one happiest memory I have is back when I was around 9. My mother worked at a school, so she was home with us during the summer, and we got to spend a lot of time together. Almost every morning, my brother and I would pull out this big plastic storage container that my mom kept under her bed full of change. We would gather up some change and go to the store with my mom. We got to pick out a snack while she got her morning Pepsi. But the best part is that we went back home and spent hours playing Monopoly. I don't know how she did it, but even without that much money, I never felt poor. I'm very lucky because I never knew we didn't have a lot of money until I looked back on things. We rarely remember the things we didn't have and the fact that we didn't have them, but we will remember what we did have and the feelings associated with them. Spoiled kids and adults are some of the most miserable people. They're constantly unhappy, even though they have exactly what we think should make them happy, because they focus on getting more instead of putting the focus on what they have. Boys add up their belongings to count their happiness, and men count their blessings.
And that's a happy note to end on.
Yes, it is.
Thank you so much, Noah.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
My guest is Noah Johnson, and his book is Boys Versus Men, The Definition of a Man. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. After a break, non-traditional college student Terry Richardson will tell how he motivates underrepresented students to enroll in higher education. Terry Richardson is a non-traditional college student at Chico State University working on a master's in social science, and he's written about his journey back to college from Texas to Iowa and now in Chico, California. The title of his book is This Is How We Do It. Terry Richardson, welcome. Now, your book says This Is How We Do It, and so that raises a question right away. Well, who is we and what are we doing?
The group of people on the back cover, we were actually the last group to go to Iowa. I was part of a program that sent people from San Antonio, Texas, to Cedar Falls, Iowa, University of Northern Iowa.
So let me explain to listeners that there's a nice color photograph on the back of your book. Your picture's on the front with this big smile that looks like that's a very natural way. That's the way people recognize you, probably by your big smile.
Yes.
And then on the back cover is this photograph. You're in this photograph, and it says XL Business Group at UNI. And UNI stands for?
University of Northern Iowa.
University of Northern Iowa. Now, how in the world would you, from Texas, what's your hometown?
San Antonio, Texas.
Okay, so there you are in your hometown, and you went to the University of Northern Iowa. What gave you that idea, Terry?
Well, let me qualify this first. I actually went to Palo Alto Community College.
In Palo Alto, California.
No,
but
not Palo Alto. It's a lot of names here. But, yeah, in San Antonio, Texas. From Palo Alto Community College, which that's what I was just going back to get my associates. First of all, I'm a veteran. So my veteran benefits paid for my up to my bachelor's degree. But so I went to Palo Alto College, and I was a business student. And I had a few what you would call a non-traditional business. Then I was self-employed. So I knew a lot about business.
So when you were going for your associate degree, were you already older than your classmates?
Oh, yes, yes. I just came back to school 5 years ago.
You'd already been a businessman. You'd been in the military. So you had life experiences that you brought to your when you started out in college already.
Yes, a whole lot. A whole lot. Yes, and I had been to college before, so I was a returning student from when I was a 19, 20-year-old kid. But, yes, I had done business, and my teachers were really instrumental for me going to Northern Iowa because I was just working on my associate's degree. So one in particular, she kind of pushed me on and said, you need to get your bachelor's degree in business or in something, you know. And I was like, I don't know. And she was like, they got a wonderful program in Northern Iowa. We sent our students up there to Northern Iowa, which the program has started back in 1999, where colleges, the Board of Regents from colleges were trying to get more minority students into colleges such as UNI.
Because I would think Iowa, being located where it is pretty white.
89%.
89% white.
Yes.
And so they go down to this school in Texas and see if any of you students are interested in attending a college in Iowa.
Yes, that's exactly what they did. And at the time, let me say this first, San Antonio is about 80% Hispanic. So actually it was a Hispanic guy coming down from Northern Iowa, which he was hired there, but he was originally from Texas. And he told the Board of Regents in his school that he would get students to come up there because back then it was 0.03% minorities. And those were probably from Chicago, and they probably were pretty much black because Chicago's four hours away. So
they give this guy this task and says, okay, you go down to this college in Texas and you recruit some students or potential students who we could invite to come attend our college up here in Iowa.
Yes, exactly. They gave him the task. I'm going to try to shorten the story, but he called a guy named Charlie Garcia, who was actually from Southern California, who had moved down to Texas, got a job, got married. And so he called Charlie, who is kind of like the transfer advisor, I would call him. Charlie is about 6'4", 350 pounds. This little guy called him and kind of challenged him. And, you know, Charlie didn't like the way he talked, first of all.
So here's this stranger calling from Iowa saying, I'm going to come down and I want you to have me some students ready. Is that what he's proposing?
That's what he's proposing. And you know, other colleges had done it before. But this one in particular, you know, they were trying to up their ratings, which it wasn't only Northern Iowa. It was most schools that, you know, were predominantly white, if you will. And so, but so they used, I can't even think of his name right now, but it starts with a C, I know that much. But they used him to provoke Charlie to get like 25 students in a room to hear his presentation about coming up to Northern Iowa. Now, and it happened for me, and it really happened because I was a veteran, but.
So you were one of these 25.
No, I'm
this
the last
This was before.
Group. Yeah,
okay.
That's the first group in 1999. Right. So the guy comes down. Charlie kind of threatened 25 people, threatened to, you know.
He twisted the arms of 25 students.
Yeah, mess
like,
up
you
their
guys
record.
Be there.
You mess up their record in school and everything. So all 25 of them went up to check out Northern Iowa.
Now, wait just a second. Here are these students in Texas, nice warm climate, and here's this school in Iowa where it snows and it's freezing cold. Why would they want to leave Texas to go this freezing college on their own dime? Are they paying their way?
That's what I was getting to. Northern Iowa paid for the plane flight to come up. It was like you were a footballer athlete. You come up, you spend 4 days there, you check out the campus, you get to know everybody there. The dean, the faculty, and everything, and you get to see Iowa pretty much. It's almost after cold season. It's like April and May, you know, so you get to go check it out. And to say that, Northern Iowa had a good educational program. So to get into that school, you know, when you look for a job, they see Northern Iowa. You know, to me, it was like Ivy League. I call it my Ivy League school because it was
Plus,
really.
You're treated like an honored guest. All expenses paid.
Yes.
They invite you up there. They fly you up there on by plane, and they honor you for those 4 days. And I could see how young students would be impressed. What other enticements did they say? Okay, good quality education. What were the other, for example, that persuaded you to leave Texas and go to Iowa?
Well, persuaded me. It was an opportunity for me. I spent most of my life in Texas, San Antonio, except for my 2 years in the military. So, I mean, most people enjoy their hometown. I got kind of tired of it. I lived there most of my life. I worked on the Riverwalk. I could see the Alamo. So that was the most entertaining part of Texas for me. And ironically, I met people up here, you know, everywhere I've been that, not very many, but that, you know, wanted to explore different places.
So that was you. You were saying, okay, I've seen San Antonio. I'm ready for an adventure.
I had to. I think that was in hindsight, that looked like my way out. Because I had wanted to leave for about 15 years. It was a way out. They were paying for my school. I mean, I didn't have to pay for everything. And
in fact, you're very complimentary to the Veterans Administration, because some of these students didn't have access to that source of funds that you had. So they were relying on a scholarship, which you really didn't need a scholarship because the VA said, hey, Terry, we'll pay for it.
Yes. And that being said, had I known earlier, probably right after I got out of the military, I probably would have went back to school earlier. Had I known that they would pay for my for me being a voc rehabilitation, you know, coming back to school.
So in a sense, you can be a mentor to younger people coming through who don't know the ropes, who don't know these opportunities that exist for them.
Yes. If you want to say veterans, yes. Matter of fact, I just did a questionnaire. I work in an internship at CSU Chico. In the Veterans Department. So I just did a questionnaire and a survey for the younger veterans, yes.
So is that what brought you to Chico? Because from Iowa, you could have gone all sorts of places you could have gone, but you chose Chico.
Well, let me qualify this. I had been to San Francisco Bay Area some 20 years ago. I went to a convention there, and it was right after the great earthquake that split the bridge. That's how long ago it was. So, you know, I was a little bit younger, and I got with a group. I had a wonderful time, you know. But I had met some friends online, and that introduced me to some more friends. So for spring break, I went to San Francisco again, and I spent 6 days there. And I had been in the non-traditional business I was in. I told you we went to different conventions. So I basically the South and the East Coast, Washington, D.C., New Orleans, Atlanta, all of these was nice. And like I said, I was just kind of looking for a place to kind of move into, and I didn't see it. I mean, it didn't feel like I could do it. But when I went to San Francisco, stayed 6 days, the weather was just beautiful. And it's like hotter than fish grease in Texas at times. So, man, it was just wonderful. And I just I liked the atmosphere. And granted, I knew San Francisco was probably, right now, it's probably the most expensive city in the nation to stay in. So let me get to this real quick. When I went to Iowa, which I said, this is my, matter of fact, when I went to San Francisco, I was just contemplating going to Iowa because I was still in college. My teachers were trying to force me out there. So when I went to Iowa, I heard about a national student exchange program. Just destiny. It was 2 weeks after I made that. And like I said, I'm still in love with California. My counselors, my doctors, everybody say, hey, you should write a documentary on California. I love California. I'd put salt and pepper on it if I could, really. But so once I seen that I could come here via the North student, I was only in Iowa for 2 weeks. So everybody thought I didn't like Iowa because the book is predominantly about Iowa and Texas. Mm-hmm. Because of the cold, and let me say this, the first week that it snowed, I was like a little boy. It was wonderful. My neighbor went and bought a shovel, and she bought something to clean her window. And I said, man, I got to get me one, you know. But after a while, it got sloppy and what have you. So I mean, I didn't give Iowa a chance, if you want to say. The people were nice. I loved Iowa. But California was it, you know. So
California was calling you.
California was calling me, the weather. And so
my guest is Terry Richardson. And the title of his book, This Is How We Do It. And I thought, well, that's an interesting title. So you're telling who the we is and what the it is. But I did not know that this is the title of a song until I read your book. Whose song is this?
The guy is from South Central California. He's 6'8". I saw him on TV the other day. That was a number one hit. This Is How We Do It. Montel Jordan is his name.
Because you're a fan of music, especially jazz.
Well, yeah.
A fan of jazz music.
Well, it's not jazz. It's more of hip-hop. So as a matter of fact, him and his wife just wrote a book by the same title, but he added something. It's about matrimony. That's his song. So
This Is How We Do It.
Yeah, Valentine's Day, they were exposing it, him and his wife, but yes.
Well, since you mentioned this rather famous guy, I didn't happen to be familiar with him, but you did actually meet somebody who is quite famous all over the world. And I thought it was interesting the way you thought, oh gosh, this is a guy who is known for not being humble. And who was this person, and what was your impression of this guy who called himself the greatest?
He really was the greatest. I met Muhammad Ali at the Riverwalk. I told you I worked at in San Antonio, Texas. He came in at midnight. They told us we were cleaning up there. I worked at a restaurant called Kangaroo Court. And so we were cleaning up, getting ready to close. And he came in at midnight, so the cooks and everybody had to lay over to make him a plate and what have you. But it was weird. I think I mentioned in the book, I had about 4 feet to 5 feet hair. I might have cut some of it off, but I had long hair when I was a kid. And he comes in the restaurant and he looks at me. At the time he came in, I was the only black until my brothers and stuff came. But he looked at me and he said, Joe Frazier. And I was like, I guess because of the mean look on my face. I said, he must think I can whip him or something, you know. But I mentioned in the book, I come from humble beginnings, and And back then, you know, when somebody talked a lot, we kind of judged. That's one thing about the South, it's the Bible Belt. We judge everything. So I didn't particularly like him because of his mouth. I really didn't. And then as I was finished cleaning up, I went to the bar to talk to my friend. Him and his wife were sitting over eating dinner. And he invited me over. He said, come on over and sit with us. At the time, he was married to the boxer's mom. And so I sat down and had a wonderful time with them. And it almost made me cry to talk about it because when he died, it was sad because I really met a class A and he was known for his personality. And so I learned not to judge a book by its cover, I'm talking, but not to judge somebody before I ever meet them.
Because you had, not really on purpose, not maliciously, but you had formed an opinion of Muhammad Ali.
Yes.
That when you actually met the real person, it changed your opinion of him.
Well, that's in any field. I've met basketball players. I met people that I consider my heroes that kind of let me down. But, I mean, it went the other way. And, like I said, I learned how to not judge anybody before I met him. And so, yes.
My guest is Terry Richardson. He is a non-traditional student at Chico State, and he's written a book, This Is How We Do It. And Terry, your book is really upbeat because you say positive things, like you're just saying about Muhammad Ali, what it was a pleasure that when he died, you felt you'd lost a friend, it sounds like.
Yes.
And then you also compliment the Army. You say, I must credit the United States Army for impacting my life greatly. The Army taught me discipline, punctuality, and persistence. And then you mentioned a young lady from Manila in the Philippines. And then a friend who taught you how to give, but not only to give, but give with class.
Yes, yes.
And you say, I worked for this man, and we became good friends. He was twice my age, but we had a lot in common.
Yes.
And so you give credit to these people who assisted you along the way.
Initially, that book was not supposed to be an autobiography, but as you know, my teacher published it for me, my humanities teacher in Africa.
And in Africa, yes, Lagos. I was amazed at that. Yeah, you had a teacher who said, Terry, I can get this book published for you in Africa.
Yes, and he did. He did.
He did.
We almost changed the title. But he was in Africa, and we only had like 2 days to get it published. So I couldn't think of another name. And then I heard Montel Jordan's story before that, and I had to stick with that name pretty much. But, yes, I was just fortunate, actually, to meet the right guy, my teacher. And, you know, he had published his own books. And so we talked about it every week. And I almost didn't go with him. I almost had a cohort, and we were looking for, like, Harper One, and
ones. You not only tell your story, because you're saying you kind of had to tell your story, but you also tell stories of other people that you knew who played a role in your life. You had other stories. Yeah. And one of them, for example, you have a little, like a photograph, a little box that says, strong people don't put others down, they lift them up. What a nice saying that is. Strong people don't put others down, they lift them up.
Yes. Well, I consider myself, I heard this guy say, I'm an eternal optimist, but I live on this earth too. So, but yes, I guess you could put me in that category. I kind of lift the others up. That was to my advisor who wrote her story, Kathy Peters.
Yes, you have the stories. Other people write their stories in your book.
Yes.
So if you're reading your book and you come across it may or may not be you. It may be one of the other people that you knew telling their stories.
Yes.
So it comes down to then, why did you write this book, Terry? For one thing, you say you learn a lot because you like to write. I mean, that boils down to you like to write.
I've read a lot of books, over 700 probably in the last 10 years. I read a lot. But I went to this conference years ago. This was like 20 years in the making. And he was famous at the time, a college football coach that stepped down. he had written a book, and I was reading it. And at the time, I was writing poetry, not getting it published, but just writing things and songs even. But I said, I can do this. And so I started, I never had no intentions of finishing or nothing. But I met my teacher, and I think this is an interesting story. Before I got ready to go to Iowa, I talked to Dr. Castillo. I said, Dr. Castillo, which one of your books should I read since, and I was a business student at the time. He says, write your own book. That's what
like
he says. But
how many writers would do that, Terry, when you say, well, which one of your books should I read? And they say, no, don't read my book. You write your own book.
Guess what? That's what I tell people now, to write their own book. And pretty much that's why I wrote it. I didn't know it at the time, but I met so many younger people, especially that want to write their own book. Matter of fact, I met a woman in San Francisco Thanksgiving. I had met her a year before. I gave her a book. She says, I'm writing my own book soon. And it just touched my heart. But it's just, it was passed down to me, so I'm passing it on to others.
One of the reasons you wrote this book was to encourage them to go for higher education, that it is possible.
Yes, and my co-author kind of helped me with that. I talked to the guy who I dedicated the book for, Charlie Garcia. And he, if you read his story, he goes into saying, like 1 out of 100 Latinos would get their doctorate, and Black was probably about 1.5. And so Carlos Casanova, which is a very interesting story, while he came back to school, he takes up Latino studies. He's getting his PhD in Iowa State, so he gave me his input. But I found it interesting because, it's entitlement society and minorities. I brought that out because we complain a lot, but we're not asserting ourselves. So,
well, I think people will be uplifted and inspired by your book, Terry, and your story. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Terry Richardson, and he wrote a book, This Is How We Do It. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.